The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is G-S-U-G-G-S insurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated December 4, 2023. As usual, the front cover is bordered in red with an inner narrow border of white, except that that blends right onto the background of the cover, which is in white, bright white, with shades of darker white into very pale gray. The motif is Time CO2, and it says Time 100 for the 100 most influential leaders driving business to real climate action. It says Time 100 Climate, and in the upper right-hand corner, in smaller print, it says our 100th year, as if it's a page-turner for one's thumb and forefinger in that upper right-hand corner. Beginning with the brief, there's a photo here. It's a full-page photo, mostly dominated by red, white, and blue. Nikki Haley's Moment by Philip Elliott. The former South Carolina governor finds momentum in a GOP primary that remains Trump's to lose. The background is probably a backdrop, perhaps, of the U.S. flag, because it's bordered in red with a wide stripe of white and an even wider stripe of blue, unless that wider stripe of blue is actually the sky behind her. Nikki Haley is forefront. She is bending over slightly to shake someone's hand. There are photographers surrounding her. She's elevated. She's on a platform of some kind. Her dark, or not dark, but medium dark skin tone is contrasted against a very bright white suit that she's wearing. And it has a texture. It has either embossing or a fancy woven weave, because it's got swirls in it, and it's really quite lovely texturally. Nikki Haley has at least shoulder length, if not longer, dark straight hair. She has dark brown eyes. She has lip rouge and very white teeth as she smiles at those surrounding her beneath the dais or platform on which she stands. Again, this is by Philip Elliott. Nikki Haley had heard worse than the snipes from one of the three men standing to her left on stage. As a candidate for governor of South Carolina in 2010, she was attacked with anti-Indian American slurs. 3 years later, the state Democratic Party chairman said she should go back to wherever the hell she came from, ignoring that she was born in South Carolina's Bamberg County Hospital. When she was the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., the Secretary of State allegedly deployed sexist words that begin with a B and a C to her face. But in Miami, November 8, when the presidential candidate found her daughter's social media usage a topic at the third debate of second-tier GOP contenders, Haley stood on the verge of boiling over. "Leave my daughter out of your voice," Haley told tech bro Vivek Ramaswamy, who had just brought up Rena Haley's TikTok. "You're just scum," she added later. Her daughter watched from the room. With her eyes cast toward the stage lights, you could see Haley push reset. and perhaps remind herself that for female candidates, combativeness is way too easily seen as rage. That clear-eyed ownership of her space in the current Republican campaign has served her well to this point, and may be what fires her into the final push before voters finally get to start having their say. Haley's the only candidate on the rise in national polls, early state surveys, and standing among donors, although ex-President Donald Trump remains laps ahead of her and every other candidate. Haley's quickly becoming a plausible chief rival and the best shot for Republicans to find an off-ramp to his third nomination. We cannot win the fights of the 21st century with politicians from the 20th century. We have to move forward, Haley said, distilling her campaign thesis that hinges on an appetite among Republican voters for a former state executive and high-stakes diplomat over a familiar former candidate. But ask John Huntsman, a former Utah governor and ex-ambassador to China and Singapore, about the two delegates he earned during his 2012 campaign for the White House with similar qualification. Haley understands the rules. She has a hawkish instinct on national security, giving her a leg up in an environment where crises in Ukraine and Israel dominate, not to mention the threats at the southern U.S. border and from China that loom as standing challenges. She is a pragmatic realist when it comes to social issues, smartly reasoning that Congress passing a federal abortion ban is as realistic as finding the Loch Ness Monster. And she has some very talented advisors guiding her in the lead-off states of Iowa and New Hampshire, plus a $10 million marker she laid down in the days after that debate to reserve advertising in those two states starting in December. The next biggest chunk of campaign money on air is from Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who's ponying up a puny one-fifth as much during the same window, and her super PAC, which can raise unlimited sums from supporters, has reserved almost $5 million more in advertising, eclipsing DeSantis's friends and their bookings. In her home state of South Carolina, Haley retains an advantage, too. She can count just one loss at the ballot in a 20-year career. Her fellow Palmetto State Paul, Senator Tim Scott, exited the race November 12, giving her a potential advantage in the first state in the South to weigh in on 2024. Also gone, the $7.5 million in ads that Scott's super PAC had reserved. But it has to be said, Haley's still far from a lethal threat to Trump right now. Being a former president has its advantages. The race, as much as it can be called that, is shaping up to be a contest for second place. The closest DeSantis ever crept to overtaking Trump was a 15-point deficit. That gap now stands north of 40 points. Haley, meanwhile, may be improving, but she is a solid 50 points behind Trump. And while emerging as the winner of the not-Trump primary matters for media coverage, the Republicans' rules do not reward second place. That means either she starts to chart a way to overtake Trump before the Iowa caucus, or she needs to persuade backers of folks like dispatched rival Scott and former Vice President Mike Pence to pivot to her camp. Or for remaining contenders, like former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie and Ramaswamy, to call it quits. It is still tough odds. Trump's hold on the party has proved durable enough that not even the prospect of voting for a jailed nominee is sufficient to dent his support as he faces multiple criminal trials in the election year. Which is why Haley has been so strategic in picking her spots to criticize her former boss, and how to respond to critiques against her that get stronger as Republicans start to pay attention to her. When Ramaswamy mocked her at the debate as Dick Cheney in 3-inch heels, she threw it back in his face. "They're 5-inch heels," Haley said. "They're not for a fashion statement. They're for ammunition. And it sure seems like Haley is here for the battle." Next is a review by Judy Berman. Fargo's fifth season is a darkly hilarious return to form. Fargo season 5 premiered November 21 on FX. There's a photo here of a man astride a horse. It's a beautiful bay horse, all set with its tack for a ride, by the gentleman dressed in blue jeans, a blue plaid shirt, and what might be a real or a fake sheepskin jacket, wearing black gloves and a tan Stetson or Stetson-like hat. Minnesota homemaker Dot Lyon, Juno Temple, has a nice, quiet life. Her husband, David Rizdahl, worships her. Their preteen daughter, Sienna King, is Dot's whole world. The only apparent obstacle to her happiness is a haughty mother-in-law, Jennifer Jason Lee, who owns America's largest debt collection agency and thinks Dot is trash. Then one day, a pair of thugs show up at the Lion's doorstep with the aim of dragging Dot back to a painful past she never disclosed to her family. She does not go quietly. So begins the fifth season of FX's Coen Brothers-inspired crime anthology, Fargo. A follow-up to season 4's ambitious yet cluttered 1950s set, Exploration of American Identity, it is a tighter, funnier return to form for creator Noah Hawley. This time, gender and class are the battlefields on which the show's eternal war of good versus evil is fought. Set in the portentous autumn of 2019, the season is crawling with law enforcement types who become avatars for different visions of justice. Fargo's stalwart good cops include a pragmatic officer from Minnesota, Richa Murajami, and her fairness-obsessed North Dakota counterpart, Lamour Morris. Two stiff FBI agents worship at the altar of rules. Best and worst of all, John Hamm plays the pompous, virulently misogynistic constitutional sheriff Roy Tillman, who is certain he's meting out divine justice and runs his squad like his own personal mafia. By the way, the photo that I described is of Roy Hamm, who calls himself a hard man for hard times. The smartly cast menagerie of oddballs makes the season a pleasure to watch. Temple's bubbliness conceals a steely tenacity. Lee drips condescension. Ham is all macho bluster. If you're looking for political resonance, you will find it in the tension between billionaire elitist and Bible-thumping populist. But this is an allegory, not a hot take. In bringing many conflicting perspectives to bear on Dot's traditionally male quest to defend the life she has built, Fargo has more elemental questions in mind. Turning the page now to 6 questions. Let me count them. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Uh-oh, I see 7 questions. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Narges, or Narges Mohammadi, the Nobel Peace Prize winner, tells Angelina Jolie about life in an Iranian prison, the roots of the protest movement, and what gives her hope. Narges space Mohammadi is shown here in a black and white, almost thumbprint size photo. She has a lot of black curly hair, very dark eyes. She's smiling slightly at the camera lens, wearing a flowery vest or jacket over a blouse that's neck high. Angelina Jolie writes this question and answer motif V. feature page. Question. When you think of your childhood, is there anything that would help us imagine the life of an Iranian family? Answer. In Iran, family relationships are not only strong among close relatives, but also with the extended family members. My mother's family was politically active and engaged. In the 1979 revolution, a significant portion of my mother's family and some members of my father's family were among those imprisoned and executed. These events directly linked the world of my childhood to the world of struggle and resistance. Question, are there things about being an Iranian woman people might not know? Answer, my mother refrained from even wearing black socks, let alone dresses. She wore lively, colorful clothing. The religious government forced us, as children of that happy mother, to wear dark and black overcoats, trousers, and headscarves. The values of Iranian families were different from the values promoted by the government. The history of my land is the tale of the struggles of freedom-seeking and tradition-breaking women, which has continued till the woman life freedom movement of today. Question, how do you keep your fellow prisoners going in such difficult circumstances? Answer, in total, since 2012, I've been imprisoned alongside more than 800 fellow cellmates. Having a political female prisoner alongside women with charges of murder, robbery, and drug trafficking can be quite challenging. From the outside, it even seemed impossible for us to coexist, but life, with all its beauties and nuances, continued inside the walls and bars. Although different political orientations and conflicting ideologies can lead to discord, we, by emphasizing our commonalities, made life there more vivid. Does your Nobel Peace Prize hold any particular meaning to you? We, the people of Iran, were able to turn our national demand into a rallying cry that became the name of our movement. Reciting Woman, Life, Freedom from the Nobel Peace Podium is a most potent and meaningful message to the people of Iran that their voice has been heard by the world. Are you able to speak to your family? Since the birth of my twins, Ali and Kiana, I've been detained 3 times. I think suffering my detentions in front of the eyes of my children, enduring solitary cells while not seeing their faces and not hearing their voices, was unbearable, beyond any word, logic, or belief. All these years, the dream of freedom and equality in my homeland, and the realization of human rights and democracy in my society have given meaning to this suffering for me. Now my dreams are my only point of connection to Ali and Kiana. Question, I've been following the tragic story of Armita Yerevan, who, like Masha Gina Amini, died after an encounter with the morality police. Answer, the pain of this horrific incident was deep and merciless because the government attempted to prevent the disclosure of the truth through deceit, lies, and duplicity. The government's effort to bury the truth is more terrifying and agonizing than its actions to eliminate its opponents and protesters. Question, do you see any grounds for optimism? Answer, our struggle to abolish mandatory hijab is a fight against the dictatorship of the religious state, which has now led to the formation of a great and revolutionary movement. In my belief, democracy and human rights are impossible without the realization of women's rights, and it is the realization of women's rights that guarantees democracy. I'm very hopeful, and this hope demands more action, effort, and struggle from me and propels me forward. Hope increases my motivation for resistance and fighting on. I know too well that victory is not easy, but it is certain. The brief, Health, Five Ways to Get Better at Saying No, by Angela Haupt. There is a common malfunction that occurs when well-intentioned people open their mouths to say no. The word yes tumbles out instead. We've all been there, says Vanessa Bones, department chair and professor of organizational behavior at Cornell University. No is a deceptively short, simple word that can trigger several layers of anxiety for the person trying to say it. We worry that we're essentially communicating we're not a helpful person. We're not a nice, kind person. We're not a team player. At the same time, we are likely stressing over how that no might offend the other person and what it conveys about our relationship with them. As Bones puts it, that's B-O-H-N-S, by the way, the professor, you might think it's telling the person, your standing with me is not what you thought it was. In reality, however, there's an array of benefits associated with learning to say no. If you're saying yes to everything, people are more likely to ask you again and again, Bones said. You wind up being the person who gets all the asks, and that can lead to burnout, problems with work-life balance, feeling like you're being taken advantage of, a loss of autonomy. Plus, an inability to say no could cause priorities such as hobbies, relationships, or projects to suffer. Each time we say yes to something, we're implicitly saying no to something else, Bones points out. Experts recommend these strategies to get better at saying no. There are five. One, be intentional about what you communicate. Bones advises emphasizing three things. It is not because of me. It is not because of you. And it is not because of us. One way to do that is by thanking people for thinking of you. Then follow up with a short explanation. I wish I could, but I just don't have the time right now. That helps make it clear that your no is not a poor reflection of your own character. You would do it. It's not the other person. You appreciate the ask. And it is not an indictment of the relationship. It is simply circumstantial. Two, buy time. If you tend to accidentally say yes whenever you're put on the spot, find ways to buy time. You might say, for example, let me think about it and I'll get back to you, Bones suggests, or let me check and I'll respond by email. That way you can spend time privately processing the request, making a mindful decision, and if necessary, declining in whatever format is most palatable. Three, be matter of fact. Delivery is everything when you are saying no. Avoid over-apologizing or otherwise acting as though you're doing something wrong, advises clinical psychologist Ellen Hendrickson. If we signal that this is no big deal and we'd like to help but can't, that sets the tone for a more neutral interaction, she says. One way to do that? I counsel students to ask difficult questions in the same tone of voice they'd use to order a sandwich. That strategy can be applied to saying no, too. You cannot help your sister-in-law's second cousin move into her new apartment. Treat it as if you're ordering a tuna sub. Hold the mayo. Four, adopt the broken record technique. If someone's applying undue pressure, utilize what Hendrickson describes as the broken record technique. It is sticking to your answer, giving the same answer again and again, she says. You do not have to be soulless about it. You can empathize and be polite, but it is important not to let your no evolve into a maybe or an okay just this once. Five, carry a visual reminder of why your no matters. If you say yes to that committee at work, what will you miss out on? Bones suggests carrying an inspirational photo that serves as a reminder. It could be your dog. It could be your kid, she says. It could be a hobby that you love. Put it near your computer or phone, and when you really do not want to do something but feel obligated to say yes, it will give you strength. Pick it up and remember, if I say yes to this, I'm basically saying no to when my daughter asks me if we have some free time to read a book later. The Brief Time with The Delicate Balance Facing William Lai, or Lai, L-A-I, Taiwan's Presidential Front Runner, by Charlie Campbell, Taipei. More than once when William Lai, that's what I'm going to try to remember to pronounce the name as, was a small boy, a passing typhoon tore the roof of his home clean away. It is a recollection that brings a wry smile to Taiwan's vice president, who grew up in the small coal mining hamlet of Wanli, perched on the islands far north. His father died in an accident in the pits when Lai was just 2 years old, leaving his mother to raise 6 children alone. Money was tight. Instead of toys, Lai had banyan trees to climb. Instead of new clothes, he wore cast-offs. He did not have privilege. He had to prove himself. Today, Lai, 64, is the front runner in Taiwan's January elections to replace outgoing President Tsai Ing-wen, who represents the same Democratic Progressive Party, DPP, but is ineligible to stand for a third term. One of the biggest assets my father left me was being impoverished, Lai tells Time in an interview in late October, because in this environment I worked harder, more vigorously on everything I did. It gave me a sense of determination. 2 days after our conversation, Lai returned to Wanli on the campaign trail, where he was greeted with presumptive shouts of, "Hello, President." After lighting incense at a lantern-filled temple, Lai promised the assembled crowd he would improve transport links and health care facilities for seniors, before turning to more weighty concerns. "My first priority is to maintain stability in the Indo-Pacific region," Lai told a throng of farmers and crab fishermen. Lai may not worry about typhoons these days, but geopolitical winds continue to batter the Taiwanese. Beijing considers the self-governing island of 23 million its sovereign territory and has vowed to reclaim it by force if necessary. It remains the most combustive of the myriad squabbles that today define relations in between the world's superpowers. On 4 occasions, President Joe Biden has vowed to protect Taiwan from Chinese military aggression. Lai knows war benefits nobody. "Taiwan hopes to be friends with China. We do not wish to be enemies," he says. The saying that all politics is local comes with an almighty caveat in Taiwan, where January's election will hinge on how best to maintain the relationship. Beijing loathes Lai's China-skeptic DPP and has branded its candidate a troublemaker. All 3 of Lai's rivals for the presidency argue they're better placed to repair cross-strait, S-T-R-A-I-T, relations, thus revitalizing Taiwan's torpid economy and safeguarding its autonomy. November 15, Lai's 2 closest challengers agreed to join forces under a single candidate, threatening to tip the balance in favor of the China-friendly camp. The vote also has profound global implications. Taiwan is the world's 16th largest trading economy, exchanging $907 billion in goods and services in 2022. It produces 90% of the world's advanced semiconductor chips, which are vital for every industry, but especially to the artificial intelligence boom. A blockade on Taiwan would imperil well over $2 trillion in economic activity, estimates the Rhodium Group, even before factoring in sanctions or any military response. An unprecedented third straight term for Beijing's nemesis DPP would represent an entrenchment of China skepticism across Taiwan society and potentially a tipping point for relations. While Chinese President Xi Jinping has called reunification a historic mission and an unshakable commitment, Li counters, "We are already a sovereign, independent country." Yet few other countries agree. Taiwan politically split from China's mainland in 1949, following the nation's civil war. Today, its government retains formal diplomatic relations with just 13 nations. The U.S. switched its recognition to Beijing in 1979, though it maintains a bevy of informal ties and is obligated by Congress to supply Taiwan with weapons. Still, attempts by Taiwan to build direct diplomatic or commercial links are met with fierce reprisals by Beijing, including military drills, a trade embargo, and diplomatic freeze. The severe downturn in China's economy has also increased fears that a crisis might be useful for Xi. Youth unemployment in China stands at 46.5% by some estimates, and the world's second largest economy again veered into deflation in October. One measure of foreign direct investment into China fell negative in the third quarter of 2023 for the first time on record. Given such doldrums, Taiwan is an easy scapegoat for China, Taiwan Foreign Minister Joseph Wu tells Time. The rising temperature spurred Tsai last year to extend mandatory national service for Taiwanese men from 4 months to 1 year. In August, she boosted defense spending to a record $19.1 billion, or 2.6% of GDP, a hike that includes purchasing 400 U.S. Javelin anti-tank missiles. "If China were to launch an invasion, we must be able to safeguard our country," says Li. Still, Li believes trade ultimately offers better protection than tanks. With Taiwanese chip makers, not ship, chip makers like TSMC powering the AI revolution, he wants to foster the next global champion to ensure the price of conflict stays prohibitively high. Semiconductors and technology industries are Taiwan's strengths, but also our responsibilities toward the international community. It is a commitment Li hopes will be reciprocated through wider support for Taiwan's democracy, which few of his compatriots would swap for China's rule. For Li, China and Taiwan may share a language and history, but precious little else. After all, Taiwan ranks 10th in the world and top in Asia in the Economist Intelligence Unit's 2022 Democracy Index. China sits in 156th place. Taiwan's politics is partisan and messy. China's ruled from Beijing's secretive Zhongmanhai leadership complex. China has banned pride since 2021 in a crackdown on LGBTQ rights. In October, Li became the highest-ranking Taiwanese official to attend Taipei's parade, saying his support was natural given his commitment to freedom, democracy, and human rights. For Li, any pretense that these two societies are in any way converging is preposterous. Ultimately, the 100 miles of choppy ocean that separates island and mainland does not do justice to how differently their people feel and think, and the coal miner's son has no qualms getting his hands dirty to keep it that way. we will not back down. There's a photo here of Lai standing at a row of windows overlooking the city. He is at the DPP headquarters in Taipei, October 24. The man has possibly graying, but very minimally dark hair. He's wearing a blue suit, a light blue or gray shirt, and a purple tie, and there are many skyscrapers behind him. Now, turning the page, I have a photograph to describe. It is two pages. It is black, white, and red. It is one of the photos of the year, indicated by time. It is by Daryl Dick or Dyck, D-Y-C-K, Canadian Press, AP. In the foreground is blackness. In the background is redness, punctuated by some black and just minimal sparkles of white. Canada's wildfires. No person is shown in this photograph. Flames encircle a mountainside above nearby homes as the McDougall Creek wildfire roared in West Kelowna, British Columbia, August 18. Extreme weather conditions fueled Canada's worst wildfire season on record, with thousands of fires devastating millions of acres and darkening skies thousands of miles away. Also, it's not known whether it's during daytime or nighttime. The contrast between the blackness, the redness, and the sparkles of white are just monstrous. The risk report by Ian Bremmer, Ukraine's endless stalemate. This is about two-thirds of a page. Things are looking up for Vladimir Putin. Ukraine's much-vaunted counteroffensive has made little progress, heightening fears in the West that U.S. and European taxpayers are bankrolling an increasingly costly stalemate. Russian counterattacks have accomplished little, but the ability of well-entrenched Russian forces to absorb Ukrainian blows without buckling leaves the Kremlin in control of about 18% of Ukraine's land. Russia's expanded its missile strikes to the highest levels this year and boosted its domestic production of missiles and ammunition. Significant material support from North Korea and more drones from Iran are helping. Putin can also celebrate the fallout from Israel's war with Hamas. The U.S. and Europe are mightily distracted by the carnage in Gaza, which is roiling their domestic politics. Western aid that might have gone to Ukraine is now sharing focus with support for Israel and humanitarian aid for Palestinian civilians trapped in harm's way. Making matters worse, Washington and European governments do not see eye to eye on this battle as they do on Ukraine. Quietly, Western leaders are warning Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky. Time is not on his country's side. More U.S. aid is probably coming. President Biden should be able to secure a decent fraction of the $60 billion he requested from Congress. Yet Western efforts to push Zelensky to begin bargaining with Putin are going nowhere for now. Ukraine's president is in no position to offer up captured land that tens of thousands of his soldiers died to defend. What could the West offer Zelensky in exchange for his willingness to begin haggling with Putin? On the economic side, the West could promise to finance full reconstruction of the country, including via the seizure of Russia's frozen assets. The European Union could promise eventual membership. On the security side, NATO could offer full membership with the protection guarantees that come with it. But Members on both sides of the Atlantic will balk at moving large numbers of troops and weapons into Ukraine and at committing to war with Russia if missile strikes continue across the country. And what happens if Donald Trump then wins the White House? What would that mean for NATO commitments and for the future of NATO itself? Knowing this, Putin has no interest in offering any credible concession that Zelensky believes he could afford to accept. He can also wait and see what happens to Western support over the next year and what American voters decide next November. Aware of all this, Zelensky has no incentive to offer anything he knows Putin will only see as a sign of weakness. The View Inbox, Health Matters, by Jamie Ducharme, health correspondent. Have you ever felt numb, overwhelmed, or excessively agitated after seeing the torrent of suffering shown on the news, internet, and social media? I know I have, and I recently learned that this feeling has a name: compassion fatigue. For decades, researchers have studied compassion fatigue among healthcare workers, therapists, social workers, veterinarians, and other people who are frequently exposed to other people's trauma at work. Over time, practitioners can develop emotion exhaustion or even PTSD-like symptoms, including difficulty sleeping, anxiety, feeling triggered by troubling stories or memories as a result of immersing themselves in the problems of others, studies show. While compassion fatigue has not been widely studied among the general population, experts I interviewed agreed that it can affect anyone, even those who are witnessing trauma from afar. That means just about everyone is at risk these days because of ongoing conflicts in Ukraine and the Middle East, frequent gun violence, and other difficult world events that are all over the news and social media. To protect yourself from compassion fatigue, the experts recommend taking purposeful breaks from the news to focus on personal wellness, such as by spending time outdoors and with loved ones, and finding ways to give back to your community and remember the good in humanity. Compassion's like a tank of gas, says Michelle Trent, executive director of a trauma-focused counseling center in South Dakota. At some point, if you don't replenish it, then you're on empty. Climate is Everything, by Alana Samuels, economics correspondent. You might be hard-pressed to find anyone who actually likes their power company. Rates just keep going up, even as many utilities drag their feet on allowing renewable energy projects to connect to the grid. There's a reason for that. Utilities are among the last monopolies allowed in the U.S., so many consumers have no choice about what company sells them their electricity. But doing anything about your utility's problems is a Herculean undertaking, as Maine environmental groups discovered when they asked voters November 7 to replace the state's investor-owned utilities, Central Maine Power and Versant, with a consumer-owned nonprofit utility called Pine Tree Power. Around 70% of voters voted no, a result that may seem surprising in a state where the two investor-owned utilities are widely reviled. Central Maine Power ranked last among large utilities in the East for customer satisfaction 4 years in a row. Advocates for Pine Tree Power called the vote the most important climate election in the country this year, but the utility spent more than $34 million opposing the referendum, and the election may have come down to money. And not just campaign spending. An independent analysis estimated it could cost Maine anywhere from $6 billion to $13 billion to buy out the utilities, which could have led to higher rates initially. Maine is not unique in getting cold feet with the idea of replacing hated utility companies. From 2000 to 2019, 60 different U.S. communities considered municipalization, essentially buying out an investor-owned utility and making it locally owned. Just 9 actually did it. According to a study by Concentric Electricity Advisors, one major reason? Buying all those wires and poles is very expensive. That does not mean there's no way to change power companies. Utilities are regulated by state commissions that ostensibly listen to public input. Getting consumer advocates elected to the commissions can help. In December 2022, for example, Louisiana voters replaced an incumbent utility regulator with Devont Lewis, an activist who spoke up for green energy and criticized the commission's lack of accountability. Elections matter, even if Maine environmentalists may not feel that way right now. Here's another installment from Times The View. Ideas, Hobbes, H-O-B-B-E-S, The Optimist, by John Gray. This is only less than a page, but it may be a bridge for time constraints. When Thomas Hobbes described life in a state of nature as solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short, he penned one of the most celebrated sentences in the English language. The 17th century philosopher asserted that without a common power to keep them all in awe, human beings fall into a state of nature, a condition of anarchical warfare and lawless predation. Hobbes' analysis resonates powerfully at the present time, when states are failing in many parts of the world, leaving chaos and crime in their wake. Increasingly, his pessimistic vision seems vindicated by a far-reaching decline in the security human beings need in their everyday lives. Yet, paradoxically, Hobbes was also an optimist. Using their reason, he believed, humans could lift themselves out of brutish conflict. Humankind could enjoy what in his masterpiece Leviathan, 1651, he called commodious living, a civilized life of peace, prosperity, and culture, through a social contract that would create a ruler all would obey. The power they brought into being, which could be a king or a republican assembly, would be unbounded in its powers, but its authority was limited to maintaining peace. No one had a divine or natural right to rule. And if the sovereign failed to protect its subjects, it could be overthrown. In focusing on individuals and their well-being, Hobbes was a liberal, possibly the only one worth reading today. Hobbes' insight that conflict is the default human situation has many lessons to teach us. One is that toppling tyrants does not secure liberty. In Iraq and later Libya, the West imposed regime change in the belief that it would lead to democracy. The result in both cases was the breakup of the state. The hard truth of which Hobbes reminds us is that politics is not a binary choice between freedom and tyranny. Hobbes also helps us understand the transformations in democracies during the 21st century. In a succession of crises, governments have moved from claiming to extend human freedom to promising shelter from danger. The 9/11 terrorist attacks and the 2007 and 8 financial crisis saw Western governments expanding their power to levels unknown since the Second World War. The process continued in the policies adopted during the COVID-19 pandemic. The state assumed responsibility for the physical and mental health of the population. Not liberty, but safety has become the overriding imperative. In sparing their citizens the anxieties that go with freedom of thought, the new Leviathans that have emerged in the West have some affinities with the totalitarian states of the past century. From one point of view, Hobbes can be read as a liberal who illuminates the loss of freedom in our time. From another, he highlights some fundamental deficiencies of liberalism. He aimed to found the authority of the state on a minimal morality that could be accepted by all. For him, that meant treating self-preservation as the supreme value. The dominant human impulse was not love of power, but fear of death. Above all, death at the hands of other human beings. Hobbes knew people are ready to die for pride and reputation. Even so, he was confident that the urge to avoid a violent end was strong enough to defeat other human impulses and support a sovereign that delivered peace. Even in Hobbes' day, this was clearly an overly optimistic vision. The wars of religion showed people dying for their beliefs in large numbers, and suicide bombers continue to do so. These religious believers have faith in an afterlife, but many of those who have died for their beliefs have had no such faith. Human beings do not value bare survival above all other things. What they seek are lives that make sense to them. In a section of Leviathan that is rarely studied, Hobbes wrote of the privilege of absurdity, to which no living creature is subject but man only. He went on to distinguish seven types of absurdity to which human beings are prone. All of them have in common the error of treating abstract terms as if they reflected actually existing entities. Unlike other animals, humans die and kill for the sake of words. Hobbes failed to admit this truth into his political theory, but that is hardly surprising, for it destroyed the basis of his optimism. Even without their propensity to absurdity, it is hard to see how human beings can extricate themselves from Hobbes' state of nature. How can they trust others, not least the all-powerful sovereign, to keep their promises? Hobbes was too optimistic. The final paradox of Hobbes' philosophy is that he showed that human beings are, in the end, ruled not by fear, but by a need for meaning that brings them together, even as it leads them into conflict. John Gray wrote this article, the entirety of which I read, and Gray is author of the new Leviathans. There's a photo here in the corner of the second page. It's of a concrete, but a battered concrete wall. The concrete's gray and mushy looking from all of the holes in it and the cracks in it. And in front of it is a patch of snowy ground, barely snowy. Maybe it's just heavy frost. And out of that ground are springing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 tulips, one of which is blooming red. The photograph is captioned "A Tulip Next to a Building Destroyed by Shelling in Rubizhne, Ukraine, April 23, 2022. Under the heading World, Man in the Middle, we'll have time for a few lines from this article. What happens when Abu Dhabi's chief oil exec is tasked with phasing down fossil fuels? By Justin Warland, Abu Dhabi. There's a photo here of a taste of the United Arab Emirates. Try cappuccino at Abu Dhabi's Emirates Palace Hotel. Mohammed bin Rashid Al Maktoum is among the largest, showcasing the UAE's climate work. It's a solar park. It's covering acres of land. In the foreground, not very many inches or feet off the ground, are these very long, perhaps a mile long, solar panels, reflecting at an angle the sun on a sandy footing, or sandy soil footing, and in the background this wide blue sky. The solar farm is impressive and the author is just as intrigued by the ride to the site, lifting off from a helipad in Abu Dhabi, getting a stunning view of the skyscrapers that have emerged from the desert that 60 years ago was an impoverished community suffering from the decline of the pearl diving trade. And from there, they fly over the Persian Gulf, where he can spot some of the UAE's offshore oil rigs in the distance, contributing to the nearly 3 million barrels of oil the country produces every day. Jaber is at the center of the energy ecosystem. He is age 50, and he's a bespectacled executive that runs ADNOC and serves as chairman of Masdar, the state-owned company he co-founded that now operates renewable energy projects in over 40 countries. They sit down and he addresses the author warmly and jumps right into his resume. He was appointed to run ADNOC in 2016, months after the world had linked the Paris Agreement, in part to future-proof the business amid the global transition away from fossil fuels. They wanted a smart, progressive disruption, he says. Progressive is a relative term. To paraphrase Al Jaber, let us get real for a minute. Is an oil and gas CEO from a petrostate the ideal candidate to lead a transition away from fossil fuels? The concerns are legitimate, to say the least. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.